Hey everyone, it's the Lady J. Thanks for checking out my podcast, I Never Told You What I Do For a Living. This episode features my friend Katie Davey. We have known each other since high school, and this is a very silly conversation, but it's also a very poignant one. Katie and I cover a lot of ground. We talk about what she wanted to be when she was little, how she ended up in the music business, and what being in the music business has meant for her mental health. It's a very honest conversation, and I'm incredibly proud of Katie for saying some of the hardest things that anybody's ever said on this podcast to date. So I hope you guys are ready to get serious and silly at the same time. And you get the added bonus of me and Katie from like 12 years ago when we were on the radio in college. So enjoy that. There'll be some little hidden gems through the podcast and on social media too. Less of me, more of Katie. Here we go. This is episode 11 of I Never Told You What I Do For a Living with Katie, the lifer. Hi, Katie.
Hi, Jordan.
I feel like we used to do this a very long time ago.
It feels oddly reminiscent, like perhaps we've been on the airwaves together before.
Perhaps. But fortunately, there are no recordings of that, so.
There are, thank God, for small favors indeed. Although I definitely have a folder of some liners we did. Luckily, it was in college and not in high school, because that's probably a bad collection of things to record.
I think there may be cassette tapes of old episodes of our Broadway radio show at my parents' house, but I don't know.
I think you're alluding to how old we are by saying there may be cassette tapes of our high school radio show.
We're old.
It's true. But it feels nice to, you know, be on a microphone with you, even if it's 3,000 miles away. This is nice.
Yeah, the internet is great sometimes, occasionally, very rarely. Katie, what is your earliest memory of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be a Jedi.
No, it's so weird that nobody has said anything like that. Like, we've had inanimate objects, but nobody has said like a fictional thing yet.
You're like, I was truly trying to think of this earlier in the week when we had been talking about me doing your podcast. And coincidentally, I went to Disneyland like a week or two ago for my birthday. And Disneyland now has Galaxy's Edge, which is a Star Wars themed land that is like a part of the park. And part of that installation is that they have a giant, quote unquote, life size Millennium Falcon. And straight up, I walked into the park, saw the Millennium Falcon, and cried. Like, straight cried. Like, got super emotional about it. And I was talking to my oldest friend. We've been best friends since we were 2.5. And she immediately messaged me and was like, yo, do you remember when we used to play Star Wars and I was Leia the veterinarian? Because she didn't have any like interest in Star Wars. She did it because I loved it. And she truly was like, yeah, to me, Leia was always a veterinarian and Luke had a weird CB radio. And that's what my knowledge of Star Wars was. But straight, yeah, I wanted to be a Jedi until I realized that like you couldn't go to the Jedi Academy for several reasons and not just because it was wiped out in the prequels. But that was the first thing I was like, yo, these are good people. Like, I want to do this. Like, also, lightsabers are sick. Can I fly an X-Wing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted to be Luke Skywalker. Gender, you know, non-withholding. That's what I wanted to be.
I mean, that's the most Katie Davey answer I've ever heard in my life. What eventually did you want to become once you realized that you could not be a Jedi?
Yeah, once I, you know, suffered that devastating blow, I didn't have a form in which I wanted to do it, but I wanted to teach, I wanted to learn more about the Holocaust, and I wanted to teach about the Second World War. For some reason, this was something that was very interesting to me as a kid, which is really morose, but I think part of me as a child, you know, this is probably around like 10 or 11, I had been reading a lot of first novels, like there's a book called I've Lived a Thousand Years, which is a story about a girl who grows up in Nazi Germany as a Jewish girl. And, you know, you go through the whole thing where you learn about her, she learns about concentration camps and all this other stuff. And I was like, this is insane. I can't believe this is a real thing. And then proceeded to educate myself as much as I could, you know, as a 10 or 11 year old kid on the topic. And I was like, this is what I want to talk about. Like, this is a thing that cannot happen. Like, this is important. I want to teach people about this and learn about this. So what started as kind of a fixation on that eventually moved into, I want to be a history teacher. And that lasted probably for a good couple of years, probably, you know, through the beginning of high school. That was kind of where my thought process was. That didn't last long, though.
Did you know people who were teachers when you were growing up?
I did, yeah. I had some family friends, and obviously, you know, just being in school, I was very lucky in the fact that I had some amazing teachers, starting from elementary school all the way through high school and you know, beyond. And those people, to me, I was like, yo, y'all are superheroes. Like, this is really, I want to affect change and influence people and give back to people like you do, which is not what I ended up doing at all, but is still something like I have so much reverence for my friends who are teachers, especially now that I hear all of like the dirty details of like what it takes to be a teacher and all of the patience you have to have.
Who was your favorite teacher from like elementary school through high school?
Well, there were a few, but all of the most important teachers in my life were always my music teachers. In particular, there is a wonderful woman named Margaret Murphy, who is still out there on the island, still teaching and still kicking shit up. And she was my choir teacher from my freshman year. And then through my senior year, I took probably like senior year, I think I was in three choirs. So that's a lot of time spent with one person. And I think just as a human, not even just as a teacher, we bonded on a level that was so incredibly important to me, especially as someone who was, you know, a 13, 14, 15 year old girl going through life shit. And we shared similar taste in music. And she was, you know, she hands down, I think probably changed more lives over like a 3 or 4 year period of time in our high school than I think anybody else in that school ever did. She, okay. I feel really lucky too, because she's someone that I still keep in contact with and still talk to. And like, she's now gone on to have children and still teaches choirs. And it's been a couple of years, but I had gone back to one of the high schools in our district that she now teaches at for like an end of the year gathering. And it was for the sock contest. We had sock contest. I'm a 3-year winner. I have the longest reign of sock contest winning, just to brag for a second. I put that on my resume, don't you worry. but it was just so crazy to see her still influence these kids and still have such an impact on these people in the way that she had such an impact on my life. Do you know what I mean? Like, it just seemed so crazy. And for a minute, I think I thought to myself, like, why didn't I become a teacher? Like, this is so, I can't get over how monumental this is. And how much of an effect she has on these people and how much of a gift she's giving them. Like, I could have done this. And then I think about it and I'm like, nah, probably not. But yeah, I mean, I had another music teacher in elementary school named Mrs. Key, who was, you know, brusque and crazy and taught me a lot of things, but also gave me opportunity. And that was really important to me. I also had a couple of really influential history teachers, which kind of aligns with what I was, you know, thinking about my future career, you know, in middle school and in early high school. And we also had a radio station at our high school. There was a teacher there named Mr. Ramaswamy, who was also an English teacher, and really was just like a gift of a human.
Yeah, he was great.
He was great. He was great. And he also, you know, I think the radio station in general, him and Mr. Laura did it, just gave me so much space to really be myself and figure out a lot of things. And that kind of led me into the next chapter of my life, and what I ended up going on to do. So
did you feel pressure either from school or from your family to go to college?
Absolutely. My parents did not go to college. My mother did a night degree. Like, I think she's got an associate's degree in that. And my father did not go to college. My dad was actually drafted into Vietnam. And then when he came back, just sort of stumbled into like a computer-ish world and is taking professional classes, but did not go to college. And so it was very important. And it was just kind of the thing that you did. You know, I grew up in a middle-class family on Long Island, and I came from a big Irish Catholic family. And there was kind of like a set expectation, but like a basis of like, okay, well, you're going to grow up, you're going to go to college. If you don't go to college, you're going to become a cop or a firefighter or some other sort of like civil servant. And then you're going to stay on Long Island and you're going to become a teacher or something along those lines. And like that's what you do. And I remember telling my mom, and she still to this day laughs about this, but in high school, I told my mom, I was like, that's my biggest nightmare, is to kind of become this thing that has stereotypically like led me to, you know, kind of projected my entire life. Like, I don't think I want that. And it, like saying that out loud, I think was really difficult, but realizing it and like, how much it scared me and like how much I just didn't want it was definitely kind of like a turning point for me.
So knowing that there was some kind of expectation, even if you weren't necessarily going to fulfill this predetermined path of like becoming a teacher or a police officer, that you were going to go on to college, how did you decide what it is that you would go on to study?
Well, we're kind of, I skipped a detour here. We took a quick detour somewhere around like the 9th, 10th grade, in which I briefly considered going to school to become a music teacher. And then spent a couple of years really hardly considering going to school for musical theater. It seems to have been a trend in many of the interviews you've done so far, but I think it's just kind of the people that you surround yourself with, is that a lot of us have a musical or a theater or an acting background that we come from that's kind of like launched us into the kind of people we are and what we ended up doing. So this summer between my junior and senior year of high school, I actually took a summer off from playing softball and went to the University of the Arts in Philadelphia for a summer for like a 6-week long musical theater intensive program. And I was like, this is it. This is going to give me an idea of what my collegiate life is going to be like, because I'm going to go to school for musical theater. I'm a theater kid. This is great. I'm embracing this. And at the end of it, I was like, I absolutely do not want to do this for the rest of my life. I hands down was like, no, I think I know that this is not for me. And it scared me for a minute, because I am a person that prepares. I am a person that has like long-term plans and goals. And even if those goals don't necessarily have dates, like they have, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a trajectory. And for a moment that was like, okay, what the fuck am I going to do now? So that was between junior and senior year. And senior year of high school, I had already been on the radio station at our high school, which was great. And I loved it. And senior year, I got to do my own radio show in the mornings once a week. It was huge. And I was like, you know what? I'm so passionate about this. I'm passionate about the music I get to play. I'm passionate about creating this thing. This is great. This is cool. I think this is maybe what I want to do. And so I kind of made another like awkward, not full 180, but like, you know, maybe like a 76 degree turn and decided I was going to major in radio, which I didn't think was a thing, but surprise, it is. And you can.
So when you were applying to colleges, then is that what you...
Yeah. So what I ended up doing was I didn't apply to a lot of colleges. I feel like I knew a lot of people who kind of blanketed. But I also feel like growing up in New York, we were really lucky because the SUNY system, the State University of New York college system, is really easy to apply to and kind of gives you the opportunity to apply to multiple schools at once. Fun fact about the SUNY system, there are only 2 schools in the system that allow you to major in radio audio broadcasting. One of them is Buffalo State, and the other one is the State University of New York at Fredonia. And I was like, well, that's about as far away as I can get from Long Island while still staying in the state of New York and paying an in-state tuition. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to apply there. That sounds like a great plan. And I also felt like I had done some research with my guidance counselor at the time, And I knew that Fredonia in particular was a huge music school. Their music education program, their music performance program, their theater program, everything like creatively was like stellar. And coming from a high school and an environment that had such strong music and arts programs, I knew that that's what I wanted to do. So I applied to Fredonia and I also applied to Buff State. And then I also applied to NYU for the Gallatin program, which is kind of like a create your own major, because I was like, yeah, I want to go to NYU. And then I didn't get in and I was like, that's probably a blessing. That's, you know, would have been cool. But, you know, I got into Fredonia like 2 days after I applied, which felt really crazy. But I was like, oh, I got into Buff State too, but I was like, I think I made my decision. Like, this is kind of where I want
to
be.
So then when you went to Fredonia, it's so funny because I'm trying so hard not to be like, I know what happens next.
You know the end,
like,
of the story.
I'm gonna tell the story for you, but like, because I wasn't inside of your head making the choices that you were making.
Yes.
So I kind of just want to, like, you went to Fredonia. I didn't go. You had a whole year before I then eventually went, and we majored in different things and stuff. But like, what was it about your experience at Fredonia do you think was most valuable?
Well, I'm going to backtrack again because I don't want to skip over the important things. And the important thing is that I did not end up getting a degree in radio audio production. When I went to school, my parents were like, listen, you know, there's a music business program at Fredonia. And I was like, yeah, I know. I don't want to do that. Like, I want to be in radio. The music industry seems crazy. Like, I don't think that's for me. Like, I don't really know if that's the game I want to play in the long run. And then I immediately put my foot in my mouth. because in addition to being one of the two schools that offers a radio degree, Fredonia is also one of the two schools in the SUNY system that offers a music business degree. And I went through my first year of college and kind of like, I didn't, coming from a radio station in a high school where I felt like I was on top of the world and very in control of a lot of things and had a lot of influence, being thrown into a situation where I had to like kind of rebuild that up was almost like it shook me a little, and I didn't feel like I fit in at first. And so I kind of played it cool, and I didn't dive headfirst into the radio station, which I feel like was the antithesis of like what my degree was going to be in. And I did some investigating and I looked around and I kind of figured out like, okay, you know, I'm not doing great in my classes. Like, what's my feel here? And I was like, you know what? Okay, let's make a shift. The music business program at Fredonia is an interdisciplinary program. So it's kind of made up, but you take business classes and you take music classes. And then there's like a core 6 or 7 classes that you take specifically that relate to like the industry at large. And so my sophomore year of college, I switched to that program and ended up minoring in like communications or whatever, because I already had all of these radio credits to my name. So that's kind of how that was the final move for me in terms of like what I was going to go to school for. And then just kind of like let it form from there. So I think your original question was, I'm sorry, what was your original question?
What do you think was the most valuable thing about your experience at Fredonia?
Ironically, being involved in the radio station. When I was a junior, this is a very you and I story. So I feel like I'm going to talk very casually about it. But when you came to Fredonia when I was a sophomore, and when we were juniors, we moved into a house together with another friend of ours and then a roommate we had found. And I remember very distinctly moving into the house and sitting at our kitchen table and looking at you and being like, this year, you and I are going to get more into the radio station. Like, we're going to do it. This is going to be the year. We're going to dive headfirst. Let's do a show together. Let's get involved. And I don't think I realized that like that was like a turning point for me. Not only did it make such an impact on my professional career, which I will get to, but like personally, I think it's the greatest decision I've ever made in my life. Like hands down, like the gift that Fredonia gave me, in addition to like, you know, an education, was the people that I met at the radio station, like honestly. And I just, like I said, it was that sitting at our kitchen table we had just moved into this house, like very central to our location. And the guys that I vaguely knew at the radio station had moved in across the street. And I was like, we're just going to go hang out with them and like see what happens. And I swear to God, like the, like if our lives were a movie, there would have been some sort of like overlay or like really dramatic music or something to indicate that like, hello, she's made a life choice.
This, the rest of the story is happening because of the conversation. I mean, honestly, though, if we could go back, I think most of the decisions that were made at that kitchen table were pretty life-altering decisions.
I mean, some of them were terrible, but yeah.
Still life-altering.
This is very true. So yeah, so honestly, joining the radio station, you and I started a show, we did on Wednesday night, the Katie and Jordan Play Music Show, or the Jordan and Katie Play Music Show? I can't remember.
No, it was the Katie and Jordan Play
Music Show. Katie and Jordan Music Show.
And I will insert the liner for it at this point in the conversation, just to-
Perfect.
Do you like the Jonas Brothers? Hannah Montana? High School Musical? Yeah, me neither.
What?
That's why I usually leave before Katie plays the last song.
Hey!
The Katie and Jordan Play Music Show, every Wednesday night here on WDVL and WCVF.
But yeah, so you and I started a radio show. I applied to be the assistant music director. Our radio station had two stations, technically. We had an internet-only top 40 station called WDVL and a terrestrial radio station called WCVF that was more of like an indie thing. And I applied to be the assistant music director of WCVF to our friend Bill, who was the music director at the time. And I was like, I want to know what goes more into programming this. I want to know what the process is. How do I get to take the bands that I love so deeply and put them on the radio? Sure, my trajectory of like the, you know, the frequency doesn't go past Chautauqua County. However, I want to make an impact. I want to do this thing. And over the course of my junior year, I learned a lot about that process in the radio station. And then when I was a senior, I became the music director of WCBF, which was another kind of like life-altering moment. Because in doing so, being a music director of WCBF, a college radio station in general, what happens is to get the music that you play on the radio, you can obviously, you know, that was a very interesting time in terms of where we were getting music from and how we were playing it. You know, whether it be, you know, not a lot of people, we had a whole vinyl, like record collection. Not a lot of people were playing things on vinyl. A lot of people were playing, okay, Jordan was playing things on vinyl. Jordan absolutely was. Not so much on CVF, definitely on DV. Like, you know what I mean? There was a balance, but
I was playing a classic rock radio show, so I basically had no choice. So
yeah, and when you put on Inagata De Vita, everyone knew you just needed a minute to take a break.
I was in the bathroom.
At that time, this was 2008, 2009, 2010, kind of like that 3-year period. The music industry in general had a humongous shift from the time that, you know, say the Backstreet Boys had the number one record selling, you know, 2 million albums on their opening week circa, you know, 2001, to a time where now in 2019, nearing 2020, you can get a number one record on Billboard selling maybe 280,000 copies of something. So I guess to kind of put it in context, the dramatic shift of the music industry, which is something I'll probably go into more a little bit later, greatly impacted kind of how, you know, what we were doing at the time. We were post Napster, we were post, you know, LimeWire, all that stuff. And we were in an era where a lot of people were doing like rips, and you were getting zips off of blogs on the internet. You were finding out, you know, you were going to see what Hipster Runoff was playing. You know, we were using Absolute Punk. You were looking at alternative press. You were ripping things off of YouTube and playing them on the radio. And so besides all of that, college radio stations in particular get serviced by different promotion companies that get hired by bands and labels and managers. And these bands and labels and managers say, hey, we think this record will be really well received by a college radio environment. So we're going to give you this record. We'll pay you to send it out to all these college radio stations and encourage them to play it. You know, no payola, like nothing. Like your job is to convince these kids that they want to play this music. So my job as the music director for WCVF was to be the conduit. And so I would get calls and emails from different Promotion companies being like, hey, like, here's a new record we've got going for ads this week. You know, do you want to put it in your rotation? It was my job to make sure that the rotation of what was being played on WCVF was healthy, had new songs, had old stuff, had classics, had things we loved, kept a certain time. We had a metal hour. You had a polka hour because God knows Fredonia had a weird polka love scene. I never will understand that. And, you know, that became my job. And in addition, you know, we had different people coming in and doing shows. So I also needed to make sure that in the booth where you recorded your show, you had all of the newest things. You knew what was at the top of the charts, whether they be the college radio charts, which was run by something called CMJ, which is the College Music Journal. You knew what was on the CMJ charts. You kind of had an idea of what was exciting and new. I also had to go through and make sure that anything that had a curse was flagged because you couldn't violate the FCC rules. But so that kind of became like my life. I was going to classes. I was learning about the music industry, and it was really great. I had one great professor in particular named Jerry Brindisi, who now teaches at the Columbia in Chicago in the music industry department. I was getting real life experience. Do you know what I mean? Like that. To me, there were times that the one thing I will say about my time in Fredonia is I did slightly regret going to school so far away from a city that I felt had a cultural impact. Like growing up outside of New York City, that's the kind of end all be all. Like you get on the train, you go to shows, you do this, you do that. There's so much stuff happening. And as much as I deeply love Buffalo, New York, it is not a cultural hub in the sense that it's a tertiary or a secondary market. It's not your main market. It's not an A market. Not all bands
come to
exactly.
Buffalo. Yeah.
So I was like, this is my experience. I also interned a lot, but I feel like I got the benefit of living on Long Island because to me, I was like, part of it was a little elitist. I realized like, you know, in hindsight, I was like, well, who am I going to intern for in Buffalo? Like, what does this make a difference? I'm not going to intern during the school year. I'll dedicate my time to the radio station and then I'll go home in the summer and I will, you know, take a moment and get an internship and like really work hard and start to make connections. And I did. And that was like another really important thing. At the time, it wasn't a requirement of my program, though it was highly recommended. Now I believe it's a requirement in Fredonia that if you major in music business, you have to do an internship.
I mean, I kind of feel like you should have to do an internship regardless of what your major is, but that's a whole other conversation.
No, I don't disagree, honestly. You know, you think about it in terms of like if you become a doctor, obviously that's a much larger process and a little bit more serious than what I do professionally. But if you become a doctor, you have to do like a certain like an internship. You need to find out what your specialty is. And when you're a teacher, you have to do student teaching, which is basically like an internship. And I feel, you know, you as somebody who did some sort of internships in publishing post college, like, you know, these are important things. It sucks. The intern culture is very, very incendiary. Pay interns is all I have to say, like pay them. They are not free service. They're not free labor. But that unfortunately is not a thing that kind of exists in the long run, but I'm hoping it's a thing that changes. However, my internship experiences were hands down some of the other most influential things that I got out of Fredonia / didn't get out of Fredonia because I did it on my own.
So where did you intern?
I ended up doing 3 different internships. I interned at an independent label called Doghouse Records. That was also a management company. And it was kind of like a jack of all trades internship, but I was mostly focused in digital, which in 2008, which is when I had this internship, I was kind of getting a crash course in how to deal with it. I was working with an artist who was blowing up and I was managing his MySpace page.
Well, because 2008 was pre-music streaming services. Like,
yes.
Spotify did not exist. Like, no. What iTunes was at the time is very different than what Apple Music is now.
Yeah, 100%. So I was doing a lot of digital stuff. I was doing a lot of digital marketing. I was doing a lot of kind of legwork to see, like, I signed up for Twitter when I was an intern at Doghouse in 2008, and I didn't know anybody else who had a Twitter. And my first two tweets are like real like weird shit because I didn't know what I was doing. And now it's crazy because Twitter is such a hugely influential platform. And to think that like at that time it was like TWTR and I like tweeted it from my phone.
Via a text message.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So I did that. And then I went back to school. And then the summer between my junior and senior year of college, I got really, really lucky. And I interned in the A&R department at Atlantic Records, which was huge for me. I am an Atlantic freak. I think, you know, historically, it's one of my favorite labels of all time. Amit Erdogan is like someone that I wanted to learn from, you know, like he did so many amazing things for the music industry. And he's just one of those people that like in the terms of a major label, and then he really trailblazed a lot of things. And then the people that came after him, like Julie Greenwald, who's still a huge player at Atlantic and Warner in general. These were the people I was like, I want to learn from them. This is great. So I interned in the A&R department and spent a summer, like, you know, again, trolling MySpaces and doing a lot of things. But I got to do this really cool, it was the only summer I think they ever did it, but they did a project for the interns where every week we got to pitch bands to like the A&R coordinators. Like it was like me and like eight other people. And we would all like gather up bands from different regions and be like, listen, like we think that these guys have potential. Like here are their numbers. Like here are the songs. Here's what they're doing. Here's what their shows are like. You know, and we think these bands are good. None of us got band signed. Are you surprised? But it was a really cool process because it gave me a lot of insight into like the functionality of what a major label is like, and sort of like, again, hands-on real life experience that I could figure out, you know, what did I want to do? The music industry is a big wide world. There's 900 things you can do in it. What was for me, you know? And then the last internship I did actually after I graduated college, I went and worked at Photo Finish Records, which was at the time actually a subsidiary label for Atlantic. So I went back to the same building I had been in the year before and got to work with some of the same people, but was working with a smaller, more kind of intimate label, working with, you know, a smaller number of bands, but way more hands-on with what I was doing. And I did that after college and got hired at my first job in the industry not too long into that, actually.
And then you lived in New York for 1,000 years.
Yeah, something like that. After college, it was hard to kind of figure out where I wanted to go for a minute. I think the very sentimental, emotional part of me wanted to stay in Western New York. I had a lot of friends, including you, who were staying in Buffalo or moving to Rochester. And I was like, I don't know what I want to do. Like, I don't have a job. I don't have something yet. My internship hadn't been in place. And I ended up staying in Fredonia and taking over as the general manager of the radio station for the majority of that summer after I graduated college. And that kind of was a really good cooling off period for me. I hadn't had like a free summer. I was someone who always had a job when I was younger. I was someone who obviously interned. Like I'm a very busy person. I like to be involved. I need to do a million things at the same time. So it was like a relaxing moment that I don't think I'll ever have again. Live in a college town in the summer when your only job is to work at a radio station from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and like basically just make sure nothing's on fire. But I moved back home to Long Island that summer and started interning at Photo Finish. I got a job I had been working at Borders throughout my collegiate experience, went back to Borders. I was the music manager there for a hot second. I did stuff on the floor. I worked in the, I was basically like, you know, did you need me to do something? Just put me wherever you need me. And then at the end of 2011, the end of the summer in 2011, I moved to Astoria, Queens, which is where I then lived for several years afterwards because I had gotten a job and was commuting and a whole lot of stuff. So I was like, oh, love you, Long Island, but not want to live in with my parents anymore.
So there, just now you were talking about making the decision about where you were going to move to, whether you were going to stay in Western New York or you were going to move home. And just as somebody who knows you pretty well, there's a little part of the story that you're not telling, which is that one of the most important bands to Katie Davey when we were growing up was a band that happens to be from a city called Chicago, and they're called Fall Out Boy. And so there was always like this thing was like, was Katie gonna go to Chicago after graduation? Did you ever seriously consider that?
I think for like a second. I think it's funny, not even in preparation for this, honestly, but accidentally, because I was looking for stuff. I was looking for some photos a couple of weeks ago. I was reading through my old live journals, and that's how you know we're about to get real, because I just mentioned the word live journal in 2019. I was reading through some of my old live journals, and I talk a lot in it about the uncertainty of where I want to be, but knowing that ending up and living in Suffolk County on Long Island was not kind of my end goal, which, you know, is related to what I had been saying earlier about, you know, I didn't want to grow up and have a white picket fence and live at Levittown and marry a cop. Like that wasn't what I wanted. Chicago isn't even mentioned there, which I think is really funny. I talked about living in Nashville or Austin or LA, and all those things seemed wildly far off for me. At that time, as I say, sitting in my home in Los Angeles. but, you know, I think too, growing up on Long Island, you know, you're right by the city. It's right there. Like, my family is from Queens. I am from Queens. Like, it just made sense. It was the easiest. And also, so many labels are there. So many jobs are there. So many opportunities. So many shows. How many venues? I mean, just the culture of music for me was very centered in New York. So in the end, it wasn't actually that hard of a decision. And also, it helped that I got a job.
Now that you're working in the music industry, whether we're talking about like now or at the point you're telling in the story, we're talking about 2011. I know I had a Spotify account in 2011. So the music industry had really started to become closer to what it is now.
It's closer to what it is now than closer to what it was in 2000. Or 1990 or 19 or any other time period. Spotify launched in the US near the end of 2011. And that was a huge turning point, because at that point we had Google Music, which wasn't really like a streaming service. It didn't really exist. I remember getting like a code from CMJ, the College Music Journal I referred to earlier, who will be a player in the story again in a minute. I remember getting a code for like 3 months free premium, whatever. And I was like, yeah, I mean, if it sucks, like I'll just not pay for it. And I still to this day have a premium Spotify account and more playlists and, you know, history in that fucking streaming service than I know what to do with. It's crazy. Because in reality, I don't own any of that.
Yeah.
And that's a really crazy thing about music right now, is that your average music consumer does not own 97% of the music that they listen to on a regular basis. I mean, don't like quote me on that statistic, but that's the basis, honestly. That's kind of like what you're looking at in a world where we stream, we hold on to less physical things in that sense. 90% of what we do is digital, something along those lines. You know, there's a small subset of people that really do care about physical media, but the general population, it's not important to them. It's not there. And they do not own so much of the things that they listen to or watch even. You know, it's the same sort of thing if you're looking at like a Netflix. You don't own any of that shit. That's not yours. When they take it off of the streaming service, you have to find it somewhere else, or you have to buy it. Like, it's not, you pay a premium to temporarily take part in something. It's not something that you tangibly have, which I think was something the music industry still struggles with, but really struggled with at that particular point in time.
So where did you go in 2011 when you moved to Queens?
So at the end of 2010, I got hit up by a friend of ours that we had gone to college with, a friend named Tim Hager. And he said, hey, listen, I moved to New York. I'm working part-time. I'm doing street teaming for this company, this marketing company. You should come out to a party. And I did not go to the party. But a couple months later, he was like, listen, I know you did radio when we were in school. there's this company also is a radio promotion company. You're familiar with it. You know it. You should come. You should send me an email. They're hiring a part-time radio promoter. And I think you'd be really good at it. And I was like, at this point, I had been kind of applying to jobs at labels. That was kind of where I thought I wanted to be. And I was like, yeah, sure, whatever. So I applied for this job and went through a whole process of interviews. They were based in Weehawken, New Jersey, which I was like, I have to go to Jersey for this? What?
Never mind.
Yeah, exactly. But so I did that and ended up getting hired as a part-time college radio promoter at the very start of 2011, which was crazy because literally like 2 years before, I had been on the receiving end of those phone calls. So I was kind of uniquely situated, as are many former radio station MDs, to be in this situation. And I'm going to say 4 or 5 months into it, I became a full-time radio promoter with a full-time job. And I ended up being a college radio promoter for about 3.5 years at that company. And it was, it was a wild ride. I loved it. I did. But like, it's the kind of thing you look at, like I'm 31 now and I look at it and I'm like, holy shit, how did 22-year-old me even fucking survive? I guess kind of too, I should clarify, because if I just say I was a radio promoter, like that's not really, you don't know what that is. I mean, you do, maybe. I don't know. Do you understand any of the things that I've ever done professionally?
I know that they mean you are never available ever. That's what I know about your work life.
I feel like later in this conversation, we're going to get real serious about some work-life balance, which is something I still don't know anything about and would like to take the recommendations of the two ladies that were on the podcast before me. So as a radio promoter, it was my job to call hundreds of radio stations across the country based at different colleges. And it was my job now for those labels and those bands and those managers to come to me and my team and say, hey, we want to hire you to promote this record. We'll pay you X amount of money and we want you to send this record out to these kids. And we also want you to get it on the college radio charts. There was an entity called CMJ, which I've now referenced several times, that managed these charts. They also had a festival every year called the CMJ Marathon that was a week in October that was like a culmination of everything. It celebrated college radio. It celebrated independent music. It celebrated corporate music. It celebrated everything. It also basically meant that I think my record was like 60 bands in 5 days or something like that. It was like an incredible, I didn't sleep. I don't think I slept from the age of like 22 to 25. Just like, quite honestly, because the thing about me is that I go all in all the time. I am a dedicated, insane person. I do not like to have downtime. I do not know what to do with myself when I'm not running at 1,000%. It's something that's very detrimental to me in the long run that I'm continuously working at now, but in my early 20s was like, I'm just going to do this 100%. I was commuting from Queens to New Jersey. I would get in work at 9:30 in the morning. I would be on the phone from 9:30 until about like 3 or 4. And then I would be doing paperwork. And then I would go to a show. And then I would go to another show. And then I would go to a bar to meet up with a bunch of people. And then I would go to bed at like 1, 2 in the morning. And then I would do it all again the next day. A thing about the music industry that I think is really interesting is that I think we're all the worst at what a balance is, because there's just so many levels of what's happening at any given point in time. You have these artists who are dedicating their entire lives to their craft. They're in vans. They're driving 8 hours at night to get from one city to the next city. They're driving through rain and snow and all these things just to share the music that they're so passionate about. And then you have people who work at labels who, if you're at the label that's right for you, these people are tirelessly working for you. They're putting in all of their energy. Digital is such a huge part of the music world. Like, if you're a social media manager, shit, man, you are on call 24/7. Like, it's so hard to like disengage yourself from that. If you're a promoter, if you're a booker, if you're, you know, just anything to do with it, like, there's just so much. The music industry is not a 9-to-5 job. And it can be very draining. It's the most exciting thing in the world, but it's also so exhausting.
I feel like it's kind of important to mention, along with, because what you're saying is incredibly important to what the music industry is and what it can do, especially to young people who are coming in at the entry level and just like running on empty all the time, is that you also don't drink or do drugs. So even though what you were doing was not great for you, you were not also than doubling down on it by doing harmful things to your body, besides like not sleeping or eating properly or any of the things that come with just being busy all the time. Because I feel like if you're already in that groove and then right. you add like tons of drinking and drugs and stuff like that on top of it, like it can just compound out of control really quickly.
I'll be really honest. I don't know how people do it. Like, just straight up. I've been straight edge since I was old enough to know like who Minor Threat was. So like eighth, ninth grade, I was like, yo, hardcore is sick. Like, this band knows what they're talking about. This makes sense to me. This is an ethos and a mindset that I understand. Like, I don't want to drink. I don't want to do anything that could impede my mind or like my clarity or like what I'm working on. Like, that's just not for me. It also helped that like none of my friends in high school really got into drinking or doing anything like drug related until we were like juniors or seniors. So like I had like time to kind of really lean into that. And then that was it for me. You know, I also come from a family that has a history of alcoholism. And I knew at that point I wanted to work in an industry that was going to include being out and at bars and all these things. And like, I've never really wavered in that. I've never cared to drink. I don't really have an interest in it. So the fact that you're absolutely right. Like, my version of this is also very different from someone who does drink and maybe had that same lifestyle as me and, you know, went to a bar at 2 a.m. to meet up with a manager and a band. And when I went home at 3:30 a.m, I was fine. Was I tired? Absolutely. But I didn't have to deal with a hangover the next day, or I wasn't still out there spending money or doing things, or like, you know what I mean? Like, that's something that I have no concept of. It's so crazy to me. But it definitely is like, it's very impactful for me. And I can't even imagine, like, obviously do what you like, you know, learn what your limits are, figure out what you're into. You know, you don't have to go all in or all out. There is a medium to get to, but in the music industry, that medium is like real. It's like a real thin sliver in the middle of like the extremes. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know very much exactly what you mean. As somebody who recently just stopped drinking entirely, it's a life-altering experience.
Yeah. So it's something that continuously kind of impacts my choices on a day-to-day basis, but it's something that I'm just so used to that, like, yeah, you know, I'm also very lucky at this time in my life to have a boss who is also straight edge, who also grew up in like a hardcore scene. And like, so that ethos is very present in like my current profession, which is really, really helpful. And, you know, of course there's always going to be assholes and that pressure you or like come at you and they're like, well, I don't understand why you want to have a drink. But like, I'm also a woman in the music industry. So like the drinking,
you got a whole other
the drinking pressure was nothing.
So what happened when you were 25?
God, I was like 24 or 25. I was still at the same company, but an opportunity came up that I was able to shift. Our company was a marketing agency, an independent marketing agency that worked specifically in music, but also in a bunch of other things. They were kind of, you know, leaning more into an experiential marketing situation, and we didn't have a social media person. And I had kind of been de facto running our Twitter and our Instagram for the company and like, you know, making sure that we had content and things like that because I had already had experience in it. And also because in my early 20s, I was very focused on my brand. So they were like, listen, we would like to offer you a position to be the, you know, the social media strategist for the company. And I was like, yes. Because being a radio promoter is kind of burning me out. And I want to be able to impact and do good things and like work on shit I like. So yeah, I'm going to do this. And then I spent the next year or two kind of trying to figure out what that social media strategy was. I didn't have any guidance. I didn't have anyone to look at. So I read a lot of articles and books that probably, you know, were just kind of full of shit. Because it was really at that point, you know, in like 2012, like, digital strategy was really just really starting to come into the forefront. I have a lot of friends who started doing digital strategy in the early 2010s who now are like, you know, running entire marketing departments for labels or for, you know, run of artists' social media, and they have millions and millions of followers. And like for them, like that was the end game. And like they were just in the right place at the right time. And I kind of just did a lot of like failing until I succeeded. Also around that time, something that was very important to me was my agency took on a huge client.
a food client that wanted to do a, they had been working on this, but it kind of like really focused at that point that we're doing a musician program. Basically, the premise is that you, if you're a band, you applied to join this program, and this fast food company, you know, will give 100 bands $500 in gift cards to their company. And so when they're on tour, they're able to eat. And I got really involved in that. And my job sort of shifted to digital media management for the company, but also doing all this stuff and being really involved in this project and picking these bands and making sure they had everything they needed and working with this company to do really cool experiential one-offs, to do some shows around festivals and around award shows and do events and like bring these people to the company's headquarters and have really cool opportunities. And like it, hands down, one up, first off, gave me some of the best people like in my life that I know professionally and that I am now friends with. It introduced me to so many artists. It introduced me to so many different things. And it was such a unique experience to be able to be like, yeah, like I do really fucking cool work for this huge corporate restaurant, but I still do it from my, you know, indie management side. And it's really cool. And I get to like bring all these bands that I love and give them these opportunities. And it was for a while there, like the culmination of all the things I think I had wanted to do in the long run. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think at that point I was like, I am in the right place at the right time for me. This is really, really good. And it was a lot of fun. It was great. And I did that for several years.
But you don't work there now.
I do not work there now. And I think this is probably the point in the conversation where we're going to start talking about anxiety and depression and sort of just self-management and self-care for a lot of people our age and also in that industry and just in general. So in 2014, end of 2014, beginning of 2015, I was not in a good place. I had had some issues through high school and through college where I had really bad anxiety and really just some really tough stuff was going through my brain. Not necessarily like events, but I was having a really hard time managing a lot of things. You know, I'm a person who holds a lot of expectations on myself, and the manifestation of me not reaching those goals was really not good, like how I was handling it. And again, as a straight edge person, I wasn't drinking about it. I was just doing like, you know, I wasn't treating myself right, you know, and working at that breakneck speed for so long, I was like, I don't know, man. And I'm from New York. I love New York. I'm going to love New York until the day I die. It's the end all be all city for me. It's got everything I've ever wanted. Do you know what I mean? Like living in Queens, I lived with one of my best friends. I loved my neighborhood and started visiting some cities that I had loved. And so I could pop home. So many of my friends lived in the tri-state area. If they didn't, most of them, I could just get on a bus and see them. But I was starting to feel incredibly stagnant. I felt like my feet were flat on the ground and my head was spinning at a fucking constant just rickety speed, you know? And I was like, I can't do this. I need to change something. Something needs to give here, and I don't know what it is. So I kind of started to travel a little bit. Shout out to, you know, 2009 LiveJournal me, visited Nashville, visited Austin, visited LA, was kind of like, what is my next step here? And at the end of 2015, I actually made the decision to move out of New York and to move to Los Angeles. And this kind of kicked off a really weird part in my life where I kind of knew, you know, you move to a new place, a new city, it's not a smooth transition, kind of no matter what you do. There's always an adjustment period. But this 2016 into 2017 was like a real whirlwind. I had the opportunity to keep working for my agency, to take that with me, and focus primarily on that music program that I was working on, which was great. But it was also kind of got downgraded to a part-time job. My company believed in me. They supported me. They wanted me to do something. But financially, structurally, it just like, why keep me on full-time? And I totally get it. Like, it was shitty at the time and it was very frustrating, but I can't fault them for wanting to do what's good for their company. You know what I mean? Like, I was doing what was good for me. Mm-hmm. So I understand that now. At the time, I was like, this sucks. And like, did I want to get a part-time job at the Barnes & Noble Cafe again that I had like done in college? No, but like, I also knew that I had bills to pay. And like, you know, I'm not above being a person that needs to work triply hard to make sure that I get done the things I want to get done. So I moved to LA and kept working for this agency. And then later that year, later in 2016, I left the agency and started working for a merchandising company, which feels like a weird shift. But hey, surprise, that band merch you buy, someone's got to get that shit together.
All those black t-shirts you own come from somewhere.
They gotta come from somewhere. Yeah, so I worked on the West Coast leg of a pretty big merchandising company working with bands I really loved. It was really cool. And it was a whole new, you know, facet of the music industry I hadn't even fucking touched. So I was like, yes, doing this. This is cool. I hated it. I did not like it at all. I don't know what it is still specifically, if it was like an environmental thing, a people thing, a job responsibility thing. I think I thought the job was going to be slightly different than it was. I had at that point had years of artist relation experience. So what I was looking for when I was looking for a new job was something that was like more hands-on with an artist, like making sure that, you know, whether it be, you know, working on a marketing team specifically with them or something along the lines where I could like interact with them in a hands-on situation. And that was what I was getting. But at the same time, like, I just didn't feel like it was the right place for me. And I was panicking, like, holy shit, should I just throw my whole career off the rails? Like, I've worked so hard to get here. I worked for the same company for 7 years, almost, you know, 6 years or so. Like, did I fuck this up? Like, what did I do? Should I have ever moved? This is terrible. Like, I went through it. As I'm sure many people have when they make like a big shift like that, you know?
Especially if you make it the big shift and then very quickly realize like, oh shit, this is the wrong, that was wrong. I don't
right, like this. Exactly. It's kind of terrifying, to be quite honest. And after being in a place where I'd felt so comfortable for so long, I was like, well, I mean, you know, there's going to be some sort of an adjustment period. And then the adjustment period just like never ended for me. So I was like, nah, we're not doing this. And then I went through a period of like, you know, a couple months where I was really trying to find a new job. And there were a couple of opportunities where I made it to like the last round. And then they'd be like, no, we're going to go with someone else. And it was heartbreaking because I had up until that point such a weird, how do I put this? It's always been incredibly important to me for my profession. I feel that I am as well-rounded as possible. I have as much knowledge about what's on the top 40 as I do what is on the alternative charts, as I do what's happening with the independent pop punk labels, as I do with what's a new hip hop artist. I want to know who your up and coming country artists are. I mean, I'm not as involved with like the electronic side of things just because it's never really been in my purview and I don't like it as much. So I don't push for it, but I still know. Like, I think it's so crucially important to be as knowledgeable as possible in your industry, which sometimes has probably been, you know, draining to me, but also like, it's given me the gift of some amazing fucking musicians, you know? But in doing that and doing the work of the agency that I had done, I fell into what I feel is the place I've been in my entire life, which is I am very good at a lot of things and I am not necessarily amazingly great at one thing, which feels true for a lot of people I know my age. Does that track for you as well?
I mean, I have to say you are probably the first person on this podcast to admit that, but I feel like it's a very common sentiment that most people feel but can't bring themselves to say out loud. So I think it's really brave that you put it that kind of blatantly.
I think it took me a while to become comfortable with that. But I mean, you know, if you've been listening to this conversation and you've witnessed this through the years, I am all over the place. Like even just to get here, I went from history to music to this. I was a classically trained vocalist. I did 13 years of Irish step dancing. I played junior Olympic softball. I played the leads in musicals. I did radio. I ran a dance company in college. I joined a gospel choir. Like I am a person who does not know how to settle. And the more that I know and the more that I do, the more I feel like I'm fulfilling myself and also maybe some sort of weird prophecy that was laid out for me. And that kind of loops back into like me not taking care of myself and me having issues with anxiety and stress and not knowing how to manage my life, because I think I put a lot of pressure on myself to be the best person I can. And I think mine, like if I'm looking at a level of of like an average level, like just putting something up on a wall, what I think I should be doing is like 800 miles into space past it. And I feel like I'm never quite hitting that, you know? And I think that is something that I have taken a really long time to get to and get to that realization. And it's something that I feel that I'm still dealing with. I'm not somebody that goes to therapy. I've been to therapy before. I've recently been having more conversations about going back to therapy. But my thought process is then there are people who have it worse than me. I can deal with this. This is fine. Like, I don't want to take up this therapist's time when they can help someone who's more in need than me. And like, wow, I'm sorry. That's 8 million red flags right there.
Yes, that is 8 million red flags. But I also think that like that is also not an uncommon thing that people are internalizing and not saying out loud. I'm not actively attempting to take my own life. Therefore, I am not worthy of therapy. Like that, like the person who's actively thinking about taking their own life was at the point where you are at some point. It might have been years ago, but like maybe if they had gone to therapy years ago, they wouldn't be where they are now. So let's maybe try and protect future you by making some choices now, preemptively.
Yeah. And it's definitely something too where it's obviously this is, I think, an issue and a stressor and a discussion with a lot of people between the ages of, say, you know, 25 and 35, this sort of generation of people where it's like, you know, there were a lot of expectations placed on us. And I know you've talked about the recession in your podcast before, and I know that it's been a big thing. I feel lucky where like I didn't quite hit that. I maybe saw it in terms of like, I didn't get paid as much as people did in 1999. Mm-hmm. Like people who get into the music industry thinking they're going to make money, like child, I have a story for you. And it's like, you know, in that sense, but I just, in the music industry in particular, because it is a continuously plugged in thing, because you are consistently involved, because you need to be aware of what's happening. You are on top of the trends. You need to be ahead of the trends. You need to book that band before they're selling out a stadium. You need to get on this band before they have a number one hit on the radio. Like, there is just a consistent need and a consistent need to know that the music industry has a huge problem with people who do not handle their problems, like their issues. And I feel really lucky because I work for a company now that really is trying to work towards that. We have our CEO brings in, you know, we have mindfulness hours. I don't take advantage of them. I probably should, but again, I'm a work in progress. I don't get that just yet, but like mental health in the music industry between artists and agents and, you know, just everybody is something that we're all trying to be like, how do we fix this? Like, we know we have to fix ourselves, but like, how do we do it? Like, what is the deal? How do we get there? And there's been a couple of really great organizations over the last several years that have like stepped up and really have, you know, tried to make an impact. And sometimes it's gone well and sometimes it hasn't. But, you know, at the reality of it is just kind of like, we all need to take better care of ourselves. And we unfortunately work in a world and live and function in a world where like, that's not the priority, you know?
Do you have trouble saying no?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I will say that I made a like an Instagram post, a thing for myself, you know, at the beginning of 2019, where I was like, this is a year of yes for me. And that seems pretty broad, you know, but in my mind, it was, I'm going to start saying yes to the things that are going to benefit me, not say yes to everything that comes my way. In the way that I think over the last, you know, 11 months, I've realized that I am saying no in the way that I am saying yes to me. I am saying no to give myself the things that I need, which in my mind is a bigger yes. You know, I've said yes to a lot of things, and there's definitely been some things where I'm like, fuck, why am I doing this? I could have been home, or I could have been working on something, or I could have been taking care of myself. Especially in the early part of my career, I thought saying no was like a death sentence. Straight up. Dead ass. I was like, if I don't go to this, if I don't do this thing, I'll lose out. I'll fuck up. Someone won't respect me, or I won't make the impression that I need to, or I won't represent my company in the way that I need to. And that is a huge problem. That is a big source of like, I'm unlearning so much of that now. And that took 10 years. You know what I mean? Like, that's 10 years of me being like, oh, okay, okay, I get it now. Like, I'm not anywhere near being in a place where, like, that makes sense and that works and I'm a level human. But I know now, and I think that's half the battle, you know?
Just being aware that it's happening.
Yeah. But even as a kid, I was not a kid who said no to shit. I mean, I just listed off all the things I did as a kid, and I'm probably skipping shit, but, like, I was that person. I had a job. I did this. I wanted to be there. The best example of this, and you're going to laugh because this is something that you experienced. I don't like to miss things. And I think that's a lot of it. I would go to parties in college and fall asleep in the corner while people were hanging out. Like that, like I just needed to be there because I was deathly afraid of not knowing what was happening. Like, how many times were we all sitting in, like, your room or our friend Keith's room, and everyone's just hanging out and chilling, and, like, an hour into it, you realize I'm curled up in a corner because I haven't slept in 3 days. Like,
and we would tease you about it, too, because everybody knew what was happening. It was just that you didn't want to – I mean, nobody wanted to miss out. That's what college, like, is. I get it.
Right, but, of course. Yeah,
but, like, that – you never really stopped doing that.
No.
Whereas
I didn't like if people.
I am the opposite. I will say yes to things and then ghost people because I don't want to go. I don't want to do it. I don't want to be there. I don't want to leave my house. I like my dog and my bathrobe. But like you never wanted to miss out on anything.
Is it because I've never had a really good bathrobe? Do you think that's the problem?
I think it's because you've never had a dog. That's what I think the problem is.
Also listen, I'm working on that. I tell my fiance every couple of days I send him another adorable, overweight, senior-looking dog that I want to bring into my home. But again, time-wise, that's not in my cards right now. I guess also we should talk about the fact that I do not work for this merchandising company anymore. I did make a jump.
You work for someone else now, yes.
I do. I currently work for the largest live entertainment company in the world.
The WWE. No, I'm kidding.
I book tours now. I work for a team of talent buyers, and I get to book bands in rooms across the country. And it's the coolest job I've ever had. It teaches me something new. Every day. It is everything I ever wanted and everything I didn't think I wanted. It causes me the greatest highs and the lowest lows. And it is something I deeply love. And I don't know where it's going to take me or where I'm going to be 5 years from now. Because obviously looking into my history, like I obviously can't predict that at this point. Who knows? I'd love to still work in a label someday. I'd love to do other things. But I am a marketer, a lawyer, an accountant, a booker, a promoter. I, do everything. I am someone's first point of contact when there is an issue. Oh, I'm sorry. You can't get there's an issue with the lighting rig. All right. I'm going to have to fix that for you. Let me talk to 900 people and make sure this works. Oh, the band didn't give you the right tax paperwork. Hold on. Let me adjust this for you. I'm going to be on this. Is this job beneficial to the way that I was trying to aim where I have a cutoff time? Probably not. I am better at not checking my emails after like 10 o'clock at night. And I'm working really hard for it not to be the first thing I look at in the morning. But living on the West Coast, it's hardly it's hard. If something's wrong on the East Coast at 9 o'clock in the morning and I need to fix it immediately, like a tour gets leaked. Or something is wrong, or there was an issue last night that needs to be dealt with immediately because this band hasn't been paid. Like, I kind of have to know, you know what I mean? Like, I am the de facto go-to person for that on my team, which is great, and I've learned so much. Like, every time I think I've learned a good amount of stuff about something in the music industry, I get a new job or I shift something or something changes, and I'm like, given this gift of all this other knowledge, which is for me, as again, someone who likes to be well-rounded, is a blessing. Like, I love knowing this shit. You want to talk about capacities in Chicago? You want to talk about capacities in Texas of rooms? Like, I want to talk about that with you. Like, you want to talk about the trajectory of this band and where they started and where they are now and like the rooms they played in between? You want to talk about it's crazy to me that at one point I was like, yeah, being a teacher would be good. I love teachers. I respect the shit out of them. But holy shit, I want to learn something new and talk about this every day of my life. And it's crazy. Again, highest highs, lowest lows. There are times when I'm writing a contract at 9:30 on a Wednesday night in my unair-conditioned office and I'm sweating going, why am I doing this? And then there's nights like last night when a band that I really like and have watched them grow sold out a 1,300 cap room in LA and we got to celebrate and there was cake.
There is often cake in Katie Davies' life, and that is really amazing.
There is. I'm also, add to that list of like professional, like jobs that I know how to do now, I'm also really great at cutting a large sheet cake with a plastic knife to serve to hundreds of people. I'm really good at it. And it's crazy too, because I think, you know, I feel like I have to talk about my relationship for a second, because I think for a really long time, I was very adamant about not dating someone in the music industry.
Uh-huh.
Because I was like, I need someone who's got some sense of reality to them. And I tried that. And whew, the problem with that was that they didn't grasp a lot of the things that I felt were important, or they didn't grasp why I used my time the way that I did. And now I'm engaged, and my fiance is an agent, so he books bands. And I mean, we try not to talk about work shit, but like, it's so good to come home and be like, yo, you hear this shit about this band? Like, you see what's happening here? Did you hear this? Like, or he, you know, books a show and there's an opening band that he loves and he wants to tell me about it. Like, that part of my life is also so great, because music in general is a universal language, and I don't make the music. You know, that's never going to be me, but I love that you and I, Jordan, can have a conversation about a band that we loved or love, or I can introduce you to someone, or you can be like, one of my friends showed me this band from England and I think you'd really like them. And like I get to have that relationship with everybody. And like, that's my career. And like, there's something just so cool about that to me.
I also, like, I need to tell everybody who's listening to this podcast that I have only ever introduced Katie Davey to one band. One. I've known her since she was 13 years old. She is 31 now. In the last 18 years, I have introduced this person to one band. One. That's it. And what band is that?
Death Row Above 1979.
That's right. So,
because I'm not giving you credit for Attack in Black. You get 50% credit for Attack in Black.
That is so rude. But whatever. It's fine.
But, you know, and I think, too, what is interesting, and, like, I don't mean this, I don't want to say this in a means of, like, trying to talk, you know, I don't want to talk or seem like I have a big ego, because I really don't think I try not to have one in anything. But in addition to, like, my career, like, my job as a friend is, like, I text people songs I hear that I think they'll love all the time. Like, oh, what, Jordan Davis and Julia Michaels just did a new country pop crossover track? My friends Caitlin and Shannon gotta know about that. Fireworks is back together and they dropped a new track. I texted you almost immediately. Like, you want to talk about the fact that, you know, post-hardcore band Daughters put out their first record in years earlier, like last year, like late last year. And like, you gotta hear this shit. Like, that's not a job to me, but like, it's part of my job. Like, my job gives me these gifts and it gives me this knowledge, and like, I feel obligated to share it. And in a way, maybe that is part of like the person that wanted to be a teacher, that wanted to educate, that wanted to like share a knowledge with somebody. Like, maybe that's the part of me that wanted to be on the radio for her life. You know what I mean? Who wanted to be, you know, given the opportunity to be like, and the next band you're going to hear is going to blow your socks off. Like, that, like, that's fun for me. I want to make you a playlist. I might take 2.5 weeks to do it, and I'm going to stress about the sequencing, but like, I want to share that. I want to give that. And I'm lucky that I have a lot of friends who are receptive to that. Do you know, like, there's definitely friends that like don't give a shit and they're like, oh my God, I wish you would. I don't care. Like, I'll listen to the song once and then never again. But like, in the same way that I'm a chronic rereader of books, I'm a constant revisitor of records. I want to know, you know, I'm going to listen to what's new and what's exciting, but I'm also going to probably listen to like Chroma by Cartel, like at least once a month, if not more. Like,
I'm so glad that I am in possession of early Katie Davey mixtapes.
Oof, they're not good.
there is some shit on those CDs that I will never not associate with you. Like Perfect, I think, by Alanis Morissette. That is a Katie Davey song.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
It's a great song. I think too, you know, obviously this podcast is very much about you talking with other people about what their career trajectories have been like and what their work-life balance is and what is work really the end-all be-all for a lot of people. And I think with you, like, you made a playlist. You wrote a play. You wrote a play that's loosely based on some of the stuff we experienced in college and life surrounding it. And in doing so, you crowdsourced a playlist from those radio boys back in the beginning of the story that I listen to all the time because songs literally catalog every section of my life, just everything. And I don't know what it's not like to not function that way. Mm-hmm. Do you know, like, that music is the most important thing to me. Like, that, like, there are people who have written songs for themselves and for other people that nail shit that I'm feeling, and that's the beauty of fucking music. Like, wow, I feel very almost famous right now. Like,
very. And if you ever feel bad, just go to the record store and visit your friends. It's why you and I sat on the fucking computer for like 25 minutes to find out that we did not get My Chemical Romance ticket. It's not just about the band that we loved when we were in high school coming back, although that's important. But it's also about, like, you and I going to that show together. Like, that's, I think, almost more important. Like, yes, if they come to the area, I will definitely go and see them. Although, let's be real, like, I will go somewhere else to see My Chemical Romance. But, like, it was about the possibility of you and I getting to do this thing together. Yes. Because the first time I ever saw them was with you.
We went to the then named Continental Airlines Arena in the fall of 2005. And we watched them play an Alkaline Trio and Reggie and the Full Effect opened. And then...
poured rain for that entire month. We were drenched. Like, all the pictures of us that exist from that show, we are completely drenched.
And you and I, when we were sophomores in college, drove the weekend before finals week. I'll never forget this. The weekend before finals week, we drove 9 hours each way to go see My Chemical Romance headline Madison Square Garden and close this era of the Black Parade album. And, like, sure, we're talking about bands.
And they played with Taking Back Sunday.
They absolutely did. Long Island represent. But it's not about this one band. Like, there are hundreds of shows I've been to in my life, thousands of shows I've been to in my life. And some of them, sure, you know, they're fine. They're great. I enjoyed them at the time, or I went because I had to, or things like that. But, like, it's driving to Ohio to go see Russian Circles play at the Grog Shop at 1 a.m. It's, you know, driving to taking a plane and going to Fest in 2012 with my friend Brian, and sleeping in a room with 6 other people because we just needed to save the money and we all wanted to be there, and then getting stranded because of the hurricane, because of Sandy, we couldn't get back to New York. I took my mom to see Fleetwood Mac at Jones Beach. It's
the time we went to New Jersey and we were the only people there to see Too Sweet. So they played all the songs that we wanted them to.
You know, it's these moments. It's so important. And I love that, specifically what I do now too. I love that I get to help make that happen for other people now. Like, that's my job. Like, I'm putting together these tours and sometimes it gets real crazy and, you know, you're negotiating how much is a band getting paid and this, that, and the other thing, or you're trying to make sure that the date you need is going to clear and that you can put them in the right size room so that it works and that, you know, the band gets to feel like they're feeling the success that they deserve and things like that. But, like, at the end of it, I'm part of making these opportunities for memories for everyday people, for people who just care about the band. Like, you know, last night, sold out show for a great band. And there's two people at that show.
I'm sorry. What? You have to say what the name of the band is, because there are a lot of people who listen to this podcast who are into wrestling, and this band used to be Mark Andrews' entrance music. So
last night, Ice Nine Kills sold out the Velasco in Los Angeles. And this last record, every song on it is based on a horror movie. And the production was great. Their dresses, characters, they brought someone on the road to like act out some scenes. And like, you know, they had a girl dressed up as Reagan from Poltergeist, like flailing on the screen when you know what I mean? Like, it's not my favorite band in the world. I think they're great. I love them. I think they're fun. I love their team. I like them. But there's two people who went to that show last night that maybe in 10 years, they're like, shit, man. Like, do you remember that Ice Nine Kills show? Like, do you remember that night? And that's it. Like, that's why I do this. That's why I wanted to do this. Because those memories are so important to me and those experiences are so important to me.
So what's the next band you're going to go see? Wait, I have a better question. Okay. I have a better question. What's the next band I'm going to go see?
Ooh, I don't know.
It was supposed to be Letters to Cleo, but I now have to record a podcast that night, so that's not happening.
So RIP, Letters to Cleo, it's been real. There are just so many. There's this guy, I'm not working at the store. There's a guy named Dermot Kennedy who's like blowing up, that is making some of the most honest and like exciting and like good, just like kind of, you know, stripped down acoustic, like really good sounding, but you know, some of the songs are acoustic, but like just genuinely good shit. There's an R&B artist that I'm obsessed with right now named Dominic Fike, who is like, I think he's like 19, he's super young, and he came out with like a 3-song EP and started like a multi-million-dollar bidding war with all the major labels. And now he's like, every verse, every track he's on is like great. I think everybody in the world should go see Lizzo.
I love Lizzo.
I think Lizzo's a great example of what patience and persistence and like taking your time like really manifests in the music industry, because Lizzo's been around for a minute and she's been making great music the whole damn time. And it's just sometimes that shit clicks and that's it. Music industry is the most unpredictable thing in the world. But man, when you can celebrate the hits as much as you can celebrate the things that are the underground or the cult classics or the bands that are playing to 200 people a night just because they want to keep doing it. Like when you've got a band like Self Defense Family, who has like a rotating cast of characters who put out probably, I don't know, they've got to have like 20, 25 EPs out by now. But like when they play, it's magic. And sometimes it's only to 200 people. Sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. But they're making magic every goddamn time they're on that stage. And like, I don't know. I know I just keep saying that's it, but like, that's it. You know,
It's funny too for me, because I think my experience with music, especially because I've had somebody like you in my life for such a long time, is that there's the music that's always going to be my music that either came from my parents or just was the stuff that I was destined to fall madly in love with, stuff like Jeff Buckley,
sure,
or you know, just like anything that was just me music. And then there's the stuff that came into my life because of the people that I was associated with, so all of the pop punk stuff that we listened to in like early college and stuff like that. And then there's music that like there's people that I know from my time being involved with wrestling that I see post music on their Instagram stories. And this like deathmatch wrestler was posting about Julian Baker the other day. Oh. And I was like, what is happening? Like, you are a hardcore kid and now you're listening to, and I'm just like, now the two of us are crying over appointments together. And like,
do you remember the first time you heard that song?
Yeah, I was in your car. And when were. The one and only time I've ever been in LA, and you were like, I don't know if you're ready to hear the song, but I think you need to hear the song like right now. And you were actually like a year and a half early, because I didn't start going to therapy until this past summer. But that song, like, I listened to that song a lot. And then when I was ready, I was like, yep, I'm not going to miss any more appointments. And I don't. So
good. Yeah. In general, good. But also, you know, it's everything, man. And, you know, I think we've kind of strayed, you know, talking about the professional side of things a lot through this podcast. But I think that's important, because my job is everything to me, for several reasons, some that I'm still trying to unpack, some that I'll probably never figure out, and some that is always going to be that kid that doesn't feel like she's doing enough. You know what I mean? But I think the tangential part of my job is equally as important. And it's, you know, now what I'm trying to take this time at this year in my life, this year of yes, yes and no, I'm realizing now was really, really good for me, because I realized that, yes, all these things are still incredibly important. And I'm still going to say yes to so much of them, but I'm also going to say no. And I'm also going to make this time for myself. I started boxing this year. That's the best gift I've given myself in years. Like, that's time for me a couple times a week that I'm, you know, not only exercising and making myself feel good, but like I'm exercising my demons and my stresses and my things. And like, I'm taking the small steps. Maybe it's not therapy. Maybe I'll never get to therapy. Maybe, you know, I'll just kind of find a balance that works for me. Or maybe I go and it revolutionizes my life. Or maybe I go and it doesn't do really much for me, and that's okay. But like, the things that I have done professionally have sort of given me this path to get to this place. And it wasn't like conventional, and it had a lot of bumps and it had a lot of twists and turns. And like I said, like, it's still not perfect. But I'm so proud of it. Like, I'm incredibly proud of the work that I've done and the things that I've done and the things that I've had the pleasure to be a part of and the bands that I've gotten to work with and the friends that I've gotten out of it. I met my fiance because the publicist of an independent label that I worked with when I was promoting radio, like college radio records, got married and invited both of us, and we were in the same place at the same time. Like, that music gave me the most important person in my existence, like my favorite human on the planet. It's crazy. It's fucking wild. And it's been, I know it's not over. Like I said, 5 years from now, I could be doing something completely different. Maybe I'll be at a label. Maybe I'll still be at this company. Maybe I'll be doing my own booking. Maybe I'll work at a venue specifically. Like, the other thing that's great about the industry I've chosen to be in is like, you could be in the same job from the start to finish, and that's fine. But you can also do 9 million things and learn something new every day. And that, I think, is what I love about it. That's the thing.
So I feel like I'm going to wrap this up, because you sort of put a nice button on the end of it, and you definitely touched on a thing that I never stop people and say, like, you're going off topic, or like, this is not related to your job, because the kind of like trick that I'm playing on everyone with this podcast is that the title, which, by the way, is the name of a My Chemical Romance song, for anyone who hasn't figured it out yet.
Here.
The name of this podcast is I Never Told You What I Do For a Living, but really what I'm asking people is what they do for their life. Like, yeah, it's not just about your job, because the thing is, we live in a time when your job is part of who you are. It's the way a lot of people identify. And for the people who don't, like my friend Erin, that is an identifier in itself. The fact that she's like, my job is my job, and when I leave my job, it is over. Like, I am not a totally different person, but I am not focused on that at all. My job stays in my office, and when I am not there, it is not a part of my life. That's why I didn't even know what she did until she came on the podcast. So, like,
when I left the agency that I worked at, the biggest problem I had was that I wasn't going to be Katie from this company anymore. I had branded myself in a way that was who I was. That was it. That's how I was introduced. That's how people knew me. I made friends on the internet based on that. I made friends in real life based on that. That was it. Like, hearing Erin talk about that, I was like, damn, what's that life like? And that maybe is the thing that I'm chasing. And maybe that's what you're chasing, and what we're all kind of looking for is like that balance. Is it's elusive, you know? Mm-hmm. It's crazily elusive. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just, like, that's hearing that, I was like, oh, people live like that. That's wild, and good for them.
But I think it's also important to know whether or not that's something you actually want.
Yes, that is also very important. That's a crucial thing.
Because there are people who want it and don't have it, and those people need to find a way to get it. And then there are people who don't have it because their job is everything to them. It's what they want most, even when they're not at work. They're thinking about work, not necessarily in like a stressed out way, but in like a, how can I learn something new or create something new or become something new? And that is a different story. And those people are never going to have work-life balance because their work is their life. And that's fine. But you have to kind of like cop to that first before you can start making decisions based on
it. That's it. You need to recognize it. And if you are comfortable with it, then live your life. Keep doing what you're doing. It's fucking working for you. Like, good on you. And if you recognize it and it's not working for you, like, that recognition is the thing. That is the fucking turning point. That's like the big, the more you know thing is like above your head. Like, that's.
And you said you weren't going to sing on this podcast. I'm
kidding. But I think I've had several moments of recognition throughout my career of like, all right, I'm getting to a point where it's getting bad. Like, I'm getting bad. This is not the balance I need. And like, I don't think I'm ever going to have a perfect work-life balance. That's just not me as a person. And anyone who knows me is not shocked by this in the least. But I know that there's a balance for me. Everyone's balance is different, you know, everyone in the way that everyone's journey is different. Everyone's career is different. Everyone's, you know, goals are different. Everyone's balance is different. It's not going to be, you know, turning off at 5 p.m. for everybody. But I hope that those people who need that find that. Truly. I truly do. Because otherwise, what's your life worth?
And the other thing, which I haven't had the opportunity to cover yet, just because I don't think I've interviewed anybody that this applies to, but the people who are currently in a quote unquote perfect work-life balance, who have a job that sustains them financially, and then they go home, who don't necessarily want that, who have a thing that they're passionate about, but haven't figured out how to make it a bigger part of their life yet. Like, I hope they find their balance too, because that can suck just as bad.
I mean, that's a whole nother conversation about side hustles and the side hustle generation that we currently exist in, and people doing the jobs to make the money to do the things they want to do kind of thing. And some people are going to live with that and be fine with it. And some people are going to ache deeply every day until they figure out how to fix it.
Katie, where can people find you on the internet? Because it is very nearly the end of the year and you will be doing what I can only assume is both a 2019 and a decade ending list. I'm not to put more pressure on you, but you have to do these things. So
the year end list is inevitable. The decade long list might not come until like February, but it's
of 2022.
Well, no, it's, you know, listen, some people have done it already and I can't say I agree to all of them. You got to take these things in stride. You got to take the time to craft them, my friends. But yes, at the end of every year, I do a large deep dive into my year of music. And I love being able to share that. And I share a big like conglomerate group list of all the shit I love, and then I narrow that shit down, and then I make playlists about it and all the things. So if you're interested or you just want to hear me rant about dumb shit on the internet, I'm on all platforms as Katie Davie, KAITYDAVIE. And if you want to hear me dive down into some other records, I'm going to promote another podcast on your podcast, because if you liked this one and you like the kind of music we talked about, you might enjoy this. I have done some great episodes on Panic at the Disco's debut album, A Fever You Can't Sweat Out, and also Bayside's self-titled album on a podcast called If You're Listening, where my friend Heather tries to teach our friend Ramsey about all the bands he missed out on by just loving the band Wings in high school. So...
Is he ever going to do an episode where he teaches her about Wings? Because that would be really...
For the 100th episode, he rewrote all of the songs he hated the most.
Wow.
And let me tell you, if you've never heard 14 different versions of One Armed Scissor by At the Drive-In, you're denying yourself things you didn't know you needed.
My God.
But I am really grateful for you for asking me to be on this and for doing this podcast, because this is a good conversation. And some people have short roads and some people like me have very weirdly meandering roads. And I think all of them are valid and interesting. And I love talking to people, not necessarily about what they do, but why they do it and how they got there. And that's why I'm stoked about this. So if anyone's made it this far, thanks.
I also just want whoever's still listening to know that I can't because of copyright issues, but just know that I want to put The Long and Winding Road on the end of this because of what she just said, but that won't happen because it would be funny now. But yeah, that's it. Goodbye. Stop listening. It's over. Everyone
end.
Go home. Goodbye.
Bye.
I'm sure by now you can understand why that episode was so long. There was just so much stuff in there. I did not want to cut any of it out because it can be really important to people to hear the kind of things that Katie was saying. So I hope you really enjoyed that. I loved having that conversation. If you want to check out Katie on social, don't forget you can find her at Katie Davie, KAITYDAVIE. You can find me on Twitter at The Lady J Says and on Instagram at The Lady J Slays. You can email me, theladyjsays@gmail.com. Make sure you subscribe and follow and do all that great stuff so that you don't miss any episodes. There are 11 behind us and so many more ahead, including next week's episode, which is going to be a little different, but you have to come back here to find out what I mean. Until then, bye.